Okay, I've got just one past the hour. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the June 15th, 2010 Wikibon Peer Insight Research Meeting, the place where peers discuss challenging problems in the data center. And I'm your host and moderator, Dave Vellante. And the topic for today is cloud backup. Wikibon is very pleased to welcome two guests from the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum who had to weather some storms. If you've seen the dangerous flooding in Oklahoma, the museum is based in Oklahoma. So Susan Adams is the Assistant Director of Development at the museum, and Sharon Casper is the Manager of IT. Welcome, ladies.
Thank you.
It's great to have you here, and we really appreciate you going the extra mile, as it were, to be with the Wikibon community today. So appreciate that. Just a few housekeeping items. Again, I'd like to ask that if you're not speaking on the call, please mute your line. It's an open line, so we get a lot of background noise sometimes, but we want people to participate. So if you don't have a mute button, hit star 6 to mute and unmute with star 6. If you want to participate, we encourage you to do so. This call is being recorded, as always, and will last 1 hour. And if you want to tweet this call, please use the #WikiBon hashtag so it will feed to our social media outlets. Well, let me set up the call here. As we know, antiquated backup and recovery processes that have been around for 30 years or so are increasingly getting modernized, and there are several technologies that are underpinning this trend, including disk-to-disk backup, and there's more available network bandwidth, and of course cloud infrastructure, which we're going to talk more about today. And the key drivers really to this are improved quality of backups, less risk to the business, potentially lower costs. And backup is really one of the most common use cases for the cloud, and been around in some form for probably more than a decade. But as always, there are issues that IT practitioners need to manage. There's, you know, security issues, recovery, performance, and other potential risks to the business. But the allure of simplicity and lower cost and higher performance make backup a perfect application for the cloud. So we're going to talk about some of that today. So as I said, based in Oklahoma City, the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum is the country's most prominent institution of Western history, as well as art and culture. The museum serves millions of visitors each year, both physically and many more online. A few years ago, management of the museum took a hard look at backup and recovery and decided that it needed to make some changes, and we're here to talk about that today. So again, Susan and Sharon, thanks for coming on. Let me start with Susan, if I may. Can you just give us a little background on the museum and your role as well?
Well, I'd be happy to, and we're pleased to be here and report that the sun is shining today in Oklahoma City, so after yesterday's heavy rains and flooding. The museum was founded in 1955 with a mission of preserving and interpreting our Western heritage and culture. And to that end, the museum has collects, preserves, and exhibits an internationally renowned collection of Western art and artifacts. We also provide educational programs, groundbreaking scholarly research, all to stimulate interest in the enduring legacy of our American West. So preservation is very much a part of our reason for existence. We are a nonprofit organization, and we are accredited by the American Association of Museums. Less than 10% of museums across the country are accredited. We are very proud of the fact that we recently renewed our 10-year accreditation. We have an extensive operation here at the museum. We are regarded as a cultural destination in central Oklahoma. We do attract families and visitors from 50 states as well as dozens of countries every single year. In addition to our visitors, we maintain a large membership database in our research center, extensive library catalogs, records, and images that are made available to scholars and the general public. We have a considerable retail operation as well as producing numerous publications. So we are multifaceted. We are not a business that is mainly dealing with email and accounting records. We have all of these other different endeavors going on throughout our museum. We are of significant size and scope of operations. We're on 36 acres here. We have about 220,000 square feet. Our annual operating budget, and we're very lean by peer benchmark standards, is just a little over $9 million annually. About half of that is earned revenue, and about half of that is unearned revenue through philanthropic support. And our contribution to the Oklahoma economy is somewhere between $45 and $50 million each year. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a snapshot of our museum and the scope of its operations.
Yeah, thank you. It's a very cool website, actually. It's nationalcowboymuseum.org, so check that out. And if you're in the area, I know these folks would love to host you. They put out an invitation to us as well, and we're excited to actually have you here today and maybe even come visit you someday.
Absolutely.
Maybe Sharon, you could tell the audience a little bit about what you do at the museum.
Certainly. I've been the IT manager at the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum for the past 13 years. Our IT department consists of two full-time IT staff that supports about 80 workstations, three dedicated servers, a handful of virtual servers, SQL databases, an Exchange server, network administration and security, a web server, web development, phone system, printers, copiers, scanners, and backups. And then in addition to all that, we just basically are there to assist our staff with their daily tasks. The different types of data that we secure are from word processing documents and spreadsheets to accounting records, museum store point of sale, an image database of over 250,000 records and over 50,000 images of archival documents that reside in our research center. We store personal information on museum constituents, membership and circulation records, and all of our collections database. In addition to that, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of large InDesign files that are created to publish our quarterly magazine, Persimmon Hill. So we're going in many different directions throughout a day.
There are a lot of diverse information assets that you're managing there. So, let me start with the question, why cloud backup? Where did that come from?
Well, back in 2007, we were needing to replace our main museum server, and this is when we first started thinking about what our backup options were. We had already experienced what everybody else experiences with traditional tape backups, the cost of the tapes, running out of time for the backups to complete, the uncertainty of a successful backup, the backup failures, the tape drive hardware problems, and most of all was the time that our IT department spent to resolve these backup problems. When I heard of cloud backup technology, I just couldn't imagine not doing a manual backup inventory or having to tote a box of tapes home with me every week. I have to tell you that my home used to be the off-site backup data center, and these tapes weren't even in a safe. They were just sitting there on my dresser. But we seriously thought about what kind of impact lost data would be to our organization. And as Susan said, our mission is to preserve and interpret the history of the American West. Losing our data would not only be devastating to the museum and our community, but it would personally affect me as the IT manager as well. So back in 07 is basically when this started. New technology to us had arisen, and it was something we thought was worth investigating some time and resources to find out what it was all about and move forward with it.
Okay, so you were doing manual tape backup, so that was obviously one of the drivers was that those processes were just becoming too cumbersome. Were there other sort of external drivers or even internal drivers to get you to really start moving in this direction, or sort of primarily the existing processes?
Well, this is Susan, and another dynamic with this situation is that nonprofit organizations are traditionally under-resourced, arts and culture institutions in particular, and there's always a tendency, particularly with our coming from the land perspective, to think that you can't afford to buy something, that you have to make it or you have to do without. But the reality of it is that we are a Smithsonian class institution here in the heartland of the Midwest, and we had a potential loss of cultural artifacts from the images that we were scanning and backing up in our research center and weren't able to do as many as we needed to do. And those things are irreplaceable to us. So it wasn't just our business data. It was the loss of cultural artifacts that was partly driving this decision, wanting to make sure that we had something that was much more effective institutionally in terms of time management and cost management, but something that we had a higher degree of trust in the reliability of the process that we were using.
That touches upon just the overall reputation of the museum as well, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, when you are supported by 50% of your money comes from philanthropic contributions, that reputational risk is significant if you're not being prudent. I have a 20-year background in telecommunications. In my peer group, former peer group, it would have been professionally embarrassing, to me if we were not taking steps to improve this particular situation at the museum.
So I guess this is a question for Sharon. Maybe you could take us back to, or Susan as well, maybe you could take us back to the project. You know, I think it was late 2007, is that right?
That is correct.
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about some of your applications. Maybe we could, talk about it's actually quite interesting. You've got a variety. You've got, traditional email and file and print, and you've got this retail operation as well. So you're supporting that, and we're talking about how many employees, how many users roughly?
We've got, I believe, 110 employees, 80 employees with a workstation.
So help us understand sort of what your infrastructure looked like back then and what the project was all about, and then we'll talk a little bit more about how that changed. So I've got some few questions around the what you looked like back then and how that changed with the project.
Well, I'm guessing we spent 10 to 15% of our day managing backups. To me, we had more priorities that needed to be addressed than spending this much time on backups daily. That was probably one of the biggest scenarios that was brought to the table. You know, can we afford to continue to battle with the tape backups day after day? Not only did we have problems with inconsistent backups, but we were experiencing hardware problems as well with the tape backup drives. When you put in a new server, you expect the mechanics to run for 3 to 5 years. Within 3 years, we had already replaced the tape drive twice. So there was a lot of downtime, getting people off the server during the lunch hour so that we could reboot to get our tapes out of the drive itself.
Ouch.
We just spent a lot of unnecessary time managing backups.
Well, I think on a risk-reward basis, this is Susan, my perspective is that we spent a lot of time for not much more protection. The reality of it was not all that useful a technology to us. It was cumbersome to, reinstall a tape and go back and search for a particular piece of data that we needed. We didn't have that, we couldn't drill down to that level very easily. It was interrupting users, and even though I talked about the extensive scope of our operations at the museum, please understand that this is a two-person department for us. So every time Sharon and her staff person are walking in and a backup is aborted, a project that she was intending to start on is now delayed because she has to turn her attention to this, and just reliability was becoming too great an issue. It's always hard to measure those intangibles, but it was clear the impact it was causing on the operation.
The backup was sucking the life out of your productivity, sounds like.
Absolutely. Right.
And then how much storage are we talking about here?
The initial seed on the cloud backup was 360 gigabytes.
Okay, so you had a situation where you're doing, what kind of backups were you doing? Sort of daily incremental and weekly full, or?
We were doing daily backups on three separate servers.
Okay. And And do you know actually what the success rate of backups was? I think Susan had mentioned it's tough to measure that stuff sometimes, but do you know what your backup completion rate was?
Oh, I would guess.
Out of 5 days, how many did it work?
We probably got one successful backup each week.
Wow.
Yeah.
And did you ever have to recover?
We did.
What was that like?
Well, we also used shadow copies, so it was kind of like, man, if these people would catch their deleted files within a few days, it'd be so much easier to just recover it from a shadow copy than it would from the tape backup. Tape backup, like I said earlier, I had to basically keep a manual log or inventory of my tape so I knew what date range was on each tape. So once you located the tape, you hoped it wasn't at your home. Try to locate the particular file on it. I mean, you're talking, again, another, probably an hour to recover one file. And again, I've got, more valuable or more pressing issues than, spending an hour recovering one deleted file.
So can you take us through the solution that you architected and talk a little bit about the cloud backup and what it involved and what the different moving parts were and how you put that together?
Well, we actually started out, to tell you the truth, looking for a business that would store our tapes in rotation. If you want to talk about the first thing that we looked at, and went to approach two or three of our corporate partners to see if their IT departments would at least provide that service while we went through this process. And then really, we set criteria, I think, fair to say, based on the challenges that Sharon and her department were experiencing. And my involvement from a development perspective was that it's a nonprofit organization. This was not in our budget. It meant that we had to figure out what the best plan was for this institution, and then I had to go out and find a donor that was willing to underwrite this for us, which we ultimately did to make this move and have been very pleased with it. So based on our experiences, we really came to it from setting a criteria. We wanted to make sure that the backup, ran properly, that it was an efficient process for us, was as automated, as possible, that they were stored, off-site, that it was cost-effective. We wanted to make sure that we were with a well-established platform that could grow with us. We were willing to beta elements, but we were looking for a vendor that knew how to service their product. And we actually found our service provider first and our technology second.
Okay, so the service provider is Corvault, is that right?
Corvault, which is a local company and who's focused on organizations of our size, small to medium organizations, 1 gigabyte to a terabyte of data. They had a well-established platform, a history of being in the telecommunications business. I was familiar with their Nortel platform for Dobson Telecom. Sharon and I toured their facility. They were designed and built for growth. And from there, Corvault introduced us to the Asigra Cloud product and technology.
Okay. So I want to get into the Asigra technology a little bit, just so people understand what it is and how it works. But I wonder, let me just stop here for a second and open it up and see if anybody has any questions for Susan or Sharon on just the whole organizational thing, the drivers, the risks that they were maybe trying to manage, or are you guys comfortable, being the audience, comfortable with the setup? So let me open it up. Any other specific questions before we get into the particular technology?
Go
ahead, Dick.
Sorry, just Dick Fulton, David. Susan, Sharon, one of the things in the invite, one of the points in the invitation was any organizational hurdles that you overcome. It sounds like you had some organizational drivers, but not many hurdles. Is that correct?
Oh, no, that would be incorrect. We had many organizational hurdles. One in particular was our data levels were very volatile. And in fact, our CFO at the time, when we entered into this agreement, wanted to make sure that we had plenty of headroom in what we had contracted for so that we wouldn't be incurring additional charges for which we had no budget. as people started using the backup, because we have so many publications, we produce in-house so many of our own invitations and other things relative to exhibitions and events that we hold, we often saw that people would have, for example, different color versions of the same image. Multiple people would have the same image stored in their common folders, et cetera. This product and technology and tools gave us a measurable device by which we could work with our users to help train them on, you know, managing their file size, et cetera, be more responsible users of our assets. You know, with just 80 users and the servers that we had, really our data backups were our limiting factor in terms of a measurement that we could use consistently to, you know, monitor those users.
So you basically had to make sure that there was no opportunity. You had to set a reasonable expectation about the amount of data you were going to back up, and then manage to that because you couldn't afford an overrun and over budget.
You know, exactly, and that was a large cultural change for us as an educational institution. People had reasons you would not believe for why it was absolutely imperative that they also have this image. But over time, Sharon and her department, you know, tried to educate people. We created a Do Not Backup folder on one of our common drives where people could place images that were backed up. You know, here with these backups so that everyone wasn't having that same image backed up multiple times.
So that's interesting. A lot of times you hear in the industry we talk about cloud is great because you get to shift capital expenses to operational expenses, but if those operational expenses are variable and unpredictable, your CFO is saying, wait a minute, I need a way to ensure that there's no surprises.
Exactly.
Right.
Interesting. There was another question, I think.
Yes, this is David. I had a sort of slightly off-center question. When you had to get the funding for this from your sources, how did you justify that the project to obtain that?
Well, we knew how much data we were going to start off with. We just did a little bit of math and increased the volume to hold us over for at least a 3-year period. I believe we contracted for 800 gigs of data for a 3-year, for 3 years. Knowing that we're going to start out at 350, maybe we'll double within a year, but within that third year, you know, we need to start thinking about what we're going to have to do at that point.
I was thinking of the business justification. In this particular case, it would be, as I understood, you got funding externally for this project from donors. How did you approach them? What was the business case, but in this case, what was the way that you got that funding?
And a very good question, and clearly this is not an implementation where we could track the P&L impact to the bottom line and, you know, retain that. So we did that much as we've been discussing on this call. The challenges we're facing, the inefficiencies were clear, the fact that we were not all that protected, and the reality of it came to, you know, making sure that the way we run this museum is commensurate with the scope of operation. And that reputational risk that I think David mentioned earlier, I don't want to say it was anecdotal, but we laid out the situation with specifics, and you know the need was clear, and we felt a reasonably priced application with greater efficiency and significantly better security.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, we've seen that in other calls where, you know, sometimes the justification is fuzzy, but you know that you're spending 10 to 15% of your time managing backup, or you know you've got some operational and organizational risks, and, you know, generally speaking, that resonates with people, but sometimes it's a little hard to justify. So I think we've learned from previous calls that that's a very effective approach to, quote-unquote, you know, selling the project. Okay, Other questions?
I have a question. Can I jump in?
Yes, please. Who's this?
Dave, this is Peter Gailey in Dallas.
Oh, hi, Peter. Good to talk to you again.
Great to speak with you again, too. Sharon, I think this question is for you. You have both said, in my perspective, some pretty things from your past environment, and I'm looking forward to hearing the positive changes that you've made that are going to protect you and your data. My understanding is your mission is to preserve data, both the transactional data and the cultural data and the historical data, correct?
Yes, sir.
Do you have what are your parameters, if you will, for very, very long-term data preservation? Meaning, have you, let me say, segregated or categorized the data maybe in an HSM strategy that basically says, hey, here's stuff that we need to keep in an authenticated form that I know it's historical cultural data that we're going to need to keep into perpetuity? Have you segregated that data out at all?
Yes, we have. We set up several different retention rules based on the type of data. One scenario is certain images in our archives or our research center, we will keep those forever. So we have a retention rule called a five-day push. Once that image has been out there for 5 days and it still resides there in 5 days, we are certain that that image will never go away. We push that to the nearline backup storage. We do have another scenario where we have some extremely large TIFF images, and again, this is in our research center. We do not want to pay for the backup on these large files. So what we do is we load them up to our server. When there's enough files there to be backed off to a DVD, we do burn it to a DVD, and then we make a copy on an external hard drive, and then we remove that TIFF image from our server. After 30 days of removal, then that image goes away. We take that off of the server, or off of the cloud backup. So, yes, we probably have a handful of, you know, 6-7 different types of retention rules.
Okay. And then, so you do have, you know, call it an information lifecycle program that you've tagged different kinds of data.
Yes, we have.
Are those DVDs sitting on your shelf at home as well? I don't mean to be a smart.
Yeah. No. You would probably be amazed. I would guess we have a section of DVDs on a wall that are about 6 foot tall and about 12 foot wide, completely full. And again, it's not the best backup because we're already finding that the DVDs didn't have the shelf life that we thought they did. We are hoping that the external hard drives will hold up to, you know, hopefully a 10-year lifespan. And we do have a smaller, you know, JPEG saved out on the server that is on the cloud backup.
So are you, let me switch, great, thank you for those answers. Let me switch gears a little bit. That data that you just referred to, that's the flag stuff, 5 days plus, and you've written it to a DVD, that is not, is that or is that not part of your normal backup routine?
That is, yes, that is part of our normal backup routine.
And would that fall out after 5 days, after you move it from a server, does that fall out of that five-day routine?
It's an ongoing process. It will never stop. We are scanning images continuously, and, I mean, that project will never come to an end.
But is that part of your backup routine, you know, does that data stay resident in your backup routine, is, I guess, my question.
Yes. And I'm not sure if you understood what I was saying is those TIFF images will reside there until there are enough to burn off to a DVD. There is a lower res JPEG that is saved on the server, and that will stay there forever, yes.
So you've got the original in a high res and then a low res closer.
Exactly.
And the other thing to note is that when we started this, it's been almost 3 years since, it'll be 3 years this fall, since we've moved to a Sigrid Cloud Backup. And when we started out, we were only using online backup. It wasn't until summer of 2008 when we were partnering with Corvault to help us manage our data levels and those changes. And also at the same time, I think there were new tools available through Asigra that facilitated web tools for moving to nearline and offline storage. And so this is an evolving implementation for us. As we become more proficient at managing the different types of data we have, as you know, more and better tools are available to allow us to make those decisions. And so, you know, with each generation, then we'll continue to evaluate our retention schemes and policies.
I have one more question, if I could. Again, this is Dick Fordham. You originally contracted for 800 gigs over a three-year period, and we're almost at that point now. How closely did you track to that growth rate from 360 to 800?
Fairly close. Right now we're at 1.2 terabytes. By the end of this month, I plan to do some more housekeeping. So I think I can get us back down to the 800 gigabyte range by the end of the month.
Okay, so you're slightly over, but I mean, I assume that maybe that additional growth means some additional business at some point, so that's not always a bad thing.
Yeah. Well, yes, absolutely. And, I mean, we were receiving reports monthly. I mean, certainly Sharon had access to more frequent data. We worked with our local service provider, with Corvault, because, you know, we'd have a major publication and we'd see significant spikes that we weren't expecting in the data that went to backup that evening. And that's where I can't say enough about having a technology and a vendor supporting that technology that helped us manage that business, because a cost overrun for us, if, you know, I know we've been making that point throughout this conversation, it was just not an option. It meant there was something else that we would not be able to do.
So I want to come back to this, like how you get rid of data. That's a really interesting topic. But before we do that, I wonder if we can talk about, because it's still a little bit unclear what the solution looks like. You mentioned Asigra, you mentioned Corvault. Can you take us through sort of what it actually looks like and how it works?
Sure. You have a piece of software, the client software. Basically, you set up backup schedules. You can have as many schedules as you wish. Tied to each of those schedules is a retention rule, and you can have as many retention rules as you wish. You also have backup time schedules. How frequently do you want to run each of your backups? So setting it up is basically a one-time setup. It's there. I can go back and change any backup schedule or backup set if I wish. I would say in the past 3 years, I've probably added an additional one or two backup sets. I've also found that there are times I'm going to place some data on our server that is not mission critical, but I do want it backed up, or maybe I only want it backed up for a month. I can go back in there and say, you know, exclude this folder. It's all new to me too. I mean, I'm learning a lot the longer I use this. Okay, so we've got our backup schedules, our retention rules, and our backup sets. That's all run pretty much every night. I start them about 4:30 in the evening. The restore, again, it's simple. Where's your data? You basically say, I want to do a store. What backup set is it in? You drill down to the file. It asks if you want to restore that to its original location, or do you want to bring it over to a different location? I mean, we're talking like a minute to do a restore on a file.
So how did you get started here? So you had several servers supporting your applications. You had about 360 gigabytes. You had to do an initial seeding directly to the cloud, or did you go to some?
Yes. No. Corvault brought in an external drive and did the initial seeding overnight, the first, you know, the very first evening. Then I'm kind of speaking for Core Vault, I'm not really quite sure, but I believe they take that vault and then they do their initial seed to their cloud.
Okay.
And then after that initial seed, basically we are just backing up additional and new files each and every night.
So they sneaker net the initial seeding with the removable drive, and then once that's done, it's just off and running.
That is correct.
Was there somebody had a comment?
Have you completely eliminated the dependence on tape now, or do Core Vault, for instance, do they have a secondary backup to tape just in case, or are you comfortable that you've eliminated all of that now on tape?
I'm sorry, I didn't follow the question.
Were you able to completely eliminate tape, or do you still have, for instance, a deep archive on tape off-site somewhere?
We no longer use any tape.
Tape is gone. Okay.
Tape is gone. The only additional backup we have are the images on the DVDs and the external drives.
So I want to just come back and make sure the solution's clear, if I may, and then we have plenty of time for some other questions. So the Asigra piece is a software as a service component. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay, and that's delivered through Core Vault, which is a partner, presumably, of Asigra's, right?
Correct.
Okay, and then there's no other hardware that you're installing?
No, this is just using our T1 line.
Say it again?
I said Core Vault has the data center.
Or anything like that, right?
We do not at the museum, no.
You're doing daily backups. Are you doing daily full, or is it daily incremental? Or?
Incremental.
Okay. So the Asigra software obviously supports that, as do many. Is there anybody from Asigra on the call, or no? Did we not?
Ashar Beg is here.
Ashar, your last name is Beg?
Yes.
So are we accurately describing the Asigra solution? Are we missing anything? Can you fill in the blanks?
You're right. I mean, the initial backup is full backup, and from that point on is incremental forever.
Okay, and so you're not doing any data deduplication, is that right? Because you're doing only incremental, is that correct?
No. I'm sorry, this is Sean. I am manually doing data deduplication, and that is by running some of the tools that are available in the client software. There are reporting tools that allow you to go out and say, show to me all of my duplicate files. Show to me all of my files that exceed, 50 megabytes. Show me the largest 200 files on the server. So that's where maintenance comes in on my end.
And so that's how you get from 1.2 terabytes down to 800, if that's your new target, is that's how you get rid of data. You use those tools, and then you identify files, you ensure that they can be deleted, and then you go in and delete them.
That is one way, yes. And then the other way is with the tiered storage. Every 6 months, we do a nearline push, and everything that's nearline will go offline. Well, not everything, but data that we feel we really wouldn't need access to that frequently.
So that's a frequency of access measurement that you use?
Yes.
And then if it hits below some threshold, then you push it?
Correct. Off. Correct.
Okay. Let's pick it up. Do you understand the Asigra solution and how it works?
I understand that it is a piece
Let me start over. Let me just say, so David, how does the Asigra solution work?
The Asigra solution works by providing a client software on the site, and that points to a piece of hardware, which is sometimes on the site or sometimes at the third-party supplier, to which you back up the incremental files, and then that gets backed up over time to the central site.
So Ashar, you were just about to tell us how the Asigra solution works, and you were going to fill in some of the blanks. Go ahead.
Absolutely. So one of the core pieces of our technology is the philosophy of aligning the data, aligning the value of the data with the cost of protecting it. So that's a mouthful, but let me explain what that means. We carve up the data into, we allow the customer to carve up their data into four tiers. The low cost tier at the far left hand side is the local only backup tier. So local only backup, the customer defines that this much of my data I can store locally. It is valuable, but it's not as critical. So I don't really need an offsite backup for this data, as long as I can store it on some disk or storage hardware that I have in-house. I'll be fine with that. And then the savings there is the bandwidth savings, as well as the speed of backup and the store, because it's done at LAN speeds. So let's say a customer A decided that 30% of their data they could store locally. The other 70% is then sent over to our to the offsite where our DS system resides. DS system is our online repository. So online repository it makes the data available to the customer in case of a disaster or failure. If they lose a file, they lose a machine, or they lose a server, or they lose the entire facility, we make that data available to them pretty much immediately. And then from that point on, the customer decides how long I want to pay for this data to be stored online. Because the third tier is archiving. The data is automatically moved over to the archiving tier by our software, and that archiving happens when the customer defines how long they want to make it online or versus move it over to archive. So if they define, in this case, customer, they define that the data moves over after 6 months to the online the archiver. From archiver, they can still recover the data. It may take them a few days longer to recover it because the extra steps that are involved, but they are paying one-third for that data, to store that data, as compared to storing the same data online. And then the final tier is what we call a BLM cloud storage, which is the public cloud. So the customer can choose to move that data to the public cloud, like an Amazon S3, and pay about 10 cents on the dollar. So the data can be moved automatically between these four tiers, and each of these tiers is a descending rate in terms of how much the customer pays for it. And all the definition of when the data actually moves over is completely up to the customer. They could define it in months or days or weeks, or they could define it in terms of generations. And once that initial programming or configuration is done, everything is automatic from that point on.
The customer can essentially set their policies and then tune the budget to those policies. Is that right?
That's correct.
Yeah, that's nice. Ashar just took us through sort of how the solution works, and I think we understand that pretty well. And then I wanted to ask you a couple of other questions, if I may. The reason why you chose Asigra, if I understand it, is because it came along with their partner CoreVault. Is that right?
Yes.
We were
evaluating both the technology and the service provider at the same time. And as Sharon, I think, mentioned, there was another there was a law firm in town. She knew their IT director, and they were a Asigra Cloud client that had given a very positive recommendation on the service.
Okay, and this, you've had this installed since late 2007. How has it worked out for you?
Perfect, seamless.
Really? So you're getting back your 10 to 15% of your time that you were spending on backups, right?
Exactly.
And then you're able to manage your costs, I presume.
Yes.
You know, we attribute a lot of that to the upfront monitoring. If there's ever an issue, the monitoring center at CoreVault has already flagged it for us. Post-implementation, I, you know, check, because obviously I need to maintain communication with, you know, all the interested parties in this initiative here. And, you know, I check in with Sharon, and, you know, the reality of it is those things were already being screened, brought to our attention, very few of them. But it wasn't a case of we were walking in and finding out we had an issue. So that just makes the day start all the much better.
So would you have done anything differently if you had to do it over again?
What I would do is do my housekeeping first. That is something we didn't think about before the implementation. I really didn't realize that there was that much duplicate data on our server. I would also educate your staff prior to going live. Let them know how critical it is to keep the junk off of the server. You know, this is a business server. We want mission-critical data backed up. We don't want, you know, pictures of your kid's birthday party and WAV files and so forth. Think about your retention rules. You know, how long do you need to keep that online? Does it need to be nearline? Can it be offline? I'm trying to think if there's anything else. This doesn't have to do with what I would have done differently, but I do have one point that I don't think that was covered, and that is on the Exchange server email. Did anybody bring up that we are now able to back up down to the message level and not just the mailbox?
No, can you elaborate?
Yeah. Well, in the past, you know, we started out with Novell GroupWise, so we are backing up mailboxes. Should you need to restore something from a mailbox, you would have to restore the entire mailbox, meaning I would lose whatever was in that box prior to the backup. With Microsoft Exchange, we are now backing up to the message level. So if you accidentally deleted a message, I do not have to restore the entire mailbox. I can drill down to that particular message and restore that. I just thought that was something people would, you know, like to know about.
Right. So the from a, what does that mean for you from a benefit standpoint?
Well, the time, you know, if you think about the entire mailbox, once I restore that, I've just possibly overwritten good data from today. So having that ability to say, I don't want to restore the entire mailbox, I only want to restore a particular message, has, you know, saves you a lot of extra steps and time.
Yeah, this is a very key functionality in the SIGRA. This is Ashur Beg again, that we allow people to restore at the message level, which means that if the CEO accidentally deletes an email and then calls the IT person and says, I accidentally deleted this email, I want it back, it can be restored within minutes, and the IT department looks like, IT person looks like a hero in the eyes of the CEO, because he just made that available within minutes back to the CEO, instead of restoring entire Exchange server that could be 40, 50,000 mailboxes, or depending upon the size of the company. So it saves on time, bandwidth, and storage costs.
And then obviously that's customer satisfaction fits in there as well. Okay, great. So I think we touched on the major questions that I had. What would you have done differently in the advice for practitioners, Sharon, is pretty much the same. Do the housekeeping first, get rid of duplicate data, you know, get the junk off the servers, and think about your retention rules, nearline, offline.
There's one other thing. The implementation, what did you have to install and put in physically at different locations as part of the implementation? And how long did that take you?
Honestly, I didn't have to do anything. I was, you know, core vault technical engineer, came out, loved the software, started the initial seed. You know, we then talked about our backup procedures, our backup sets, our retention rules, and so forth. So within a half a day, maybe that was a half a day of my time doing the implementation. And after that, again, once everything is set up correctly, there isn't anything else to do. You know, wait for someone to request information from you.
I'd say the only other, I don't know that we'd necessarily do this differently, the only other surprise we had in that initial seed was really we had not estimated our compression as realistically as we weren't on target with that, and it really it was due to the fact that we were so image rich in our data that there was quite a bit more coming across in that initial seed, and then we wound up doing that again that next night.
Right.
Okay, great. So,
And one more comment. This is Ashur Beg again. You asked the question in terms of what did you have to do to install the software. There's one software called the DS client that gets installed on the customer site, and you only need to install it on one machine on the entire network, and it will pick up, it collects the data that needs to be backed up from all the machines on that network. Desktop, laptop, servers, you name it, and then sends it over to the ISP data center, in this case Core Vault, to be backed up. So there are no agents. We're an agentless technology, so there are no agents that you need to install or maintain or update each time there is a hot fix or a new release and so on. So it's a very less labor intensive process.
And what do you refer to that software component again? How do you refer to it?
It's called the DS client. So this is a DS client, and this is the client software that resides at the customer end. And the software that resides at the MSP end at the inside Core Vault is called the DS system. So these are the two main components of our software: the DS client and the DS system.
And that's D like David.
Yes. So capital D, capital S, dash, capital S, system.
And capital C, client.
That's correct.
Got it. Okay.
Okay, folks, we have to wrap. So on behalf of the Wikibon community, I'd really like to thank Susan Adams and Sharon Casper from the National Cowboy and Western Heritage Museum for joining us today. Please, if you're down in Oklahoma City, please visit. And I'd also like to thank the other Wikibon members who contributed to the call today. Dick Fordham, thanks for your questions. David Floyer, Peter Gailey, and Ashur Beg, thank you very much for your comments and perspectives. As a reminder, our next Peer Insight meeting is scheduled for 12 noon Eastern Time. That'll be on Tuesday, June 29th, 2010. And the topic is a chat with Richie Larry and Steve Sekola. Now, if you don't know Richie and Steve, Richie Larry and Steve Sekola are storage industry legends. And we're going to have an open discussion with these visionaries around the direction of technology. It should be very, very interesting, and looking forward to that. And as another reminder, over the next 24 hours or so, we'll have up on Wikibon 6 research notes pertaining to the call today. They'll have user action, so look for that. And feel free to hit the edit tab to improve the pieces, or, hey, put up your own piece, or even write a wiki tip. We'll also be producing a podcast of this call, and we'll be sending that out as well. So thanks for listening, everyone, and thanks for being a Wikibon member. Bye for now.